Okay, thank you. So indeed, I'm going to give some lectures on something we are now starting to do with Miguel Paulus, João Penedones, John, and Baltman Rees. And this is pretty much work in progress, so please don't spread too much. And what we are trying to understand is what kind of constraints, how can we try to understand strongly coupled quantum field theories where traditional methods fall short, so where we don't have perturbation theory or other tools at our disposal. So let me start with some general motivation of some basic words that we would always say. So suppose I want to compute, say, even in some strongly coupled theory like pure glue, what is, say, the mass of the second glue ball over the mass of the first one? Right? This is a question I could try to understand in a strongly coupled gauge theory, which would be purely non-perturbative and one which is not an easy one to address. I could also ask, what is the coupling between these glue balls, between, say, a glue ball of mass M1, M1, and M2, for example? What would be the coupling between these glue balls? Measured, if you want, by what would be the S matrix between these glue balls, what are the poles and the residues at this pole. So this is tough. These kind of questions are tough because it's hard to solve strongly coupled quantum field theories. Similar questions we could ask, the same thing, for, say, another strongly coupled field theory. We did the Ising field theory with temperature and magnetic field. So if we go, say, to the critical model, to the critical point where we are at the critical temperature without magnetic field, we have a conformal field theory. And then if I add some magnetic field, or if I turn on some temperature above the critical temperature or below, I flow into some massive theory. And I could again ask, what is the spectrum? What is the second mass measured in units of the first mass? What are the couplings between, say, the lightest particles, between the lightest particles, and so on? Just to give you an idea, while this problem is a very tough one, this one is at least one where we have lattice field theory and where we could at least put in a computer, do Monte Carlo, and try to more easily get data about this problem. But still, it is a hard problem. Just to give you an idea, in two dimensions, for example, this problem is solved if you just turn on temperature, or if you just turn on magnetic field, but if you turn on both, you cannot solve this model exactly. Right? So let me just write it here. So this problem, for example, is solved in two dimensions for either no magnetic field or T equal T critical. Okay? So if we have no magnetic field, we know that Ising field theory flows to a theory of a massive fermion, a massive free fermion. And if we are at the critical temperature and turn on magnetic field, it solves to a complicated massive theory with E8 symmetry that Zamolodnikov predicted a few years ago and which was experimentally checked also a few years ago in the lab, some condensed matter setup. So there are at least these two points, a theory of one free fermion in one case, if you keep the magnetic field zero and turn on the temperature, and a theory with eight species of particles, eight kinds of particles with E8 symmetry if you stay at the critical temperature and turn magnetic field. And if you turn both on, you flow to some massive field theory, and you have, for example, little tools to address and to understand what is the mass spectrum, what are the couplings in this theory, and so on, at least to the far as much as I know. Okay? So these are the kind of questions we would like to understand, of course. And the idea is to start, motivated by recent progress, as I will tell you soon, in the conformal bootstrap, is to start asking first simpler questions, which are related to bounds, which are related to trying to ask what is the space of quantum field theories. If I cannot ask exactly what is the coupling, perhaps I can at least establish bounds on this coupling and say that these couplings must be between this value and this value. And the idea, there are two main hopes in this kind of approach where you try to establish bounds. One hope is that when you establish bounds, interesting theories might lie at the boundary of these bounds. They might saturate the bounds. This is indeed what happens in many examples that people studied recently of bounds in the conformal field theories. Indeed, they have some bounds, and then some nice points at the boundary of these bounds correspond to interesting physical theories. But even if we are not so lucky, what often happens is that you have some, often you manage to have so many, you ask so many questions about the theory, you establish so many bounds, that the surface which is allowed becomes kind of islands. So if you have an upper bound and a lower bound, you can almost isolate the theory. So sometimes if you ask enough questions, your bounds can already give you some kind of small islands where your theory lives, and then it's roughly as good as having equalities if your islands are very small. And indeed, this kind of philosophy is what underlies the recent developments in the conformal bootstrap, and the best exponents of the critical Ising field theory at the critical point, the best exponents, say in three dimensions, are obtained precisely by extracting these bounds and forming islands that are so small that they are smaller than the Ecker bars of Monte Carlo, say, if you were to compute it directly. Okay? So just to be a bit more explicit, let me give you an example of a kind of question we would ask. Suppose we ask the following question. Let me say I have a quantum field theory, and I consider the S matrix where I scatter the lightest particle of my theory, four identical particles. And let me say that here, there is the lightest exchanged particle is M1, okay, as a mass M1. Let's measure it always in over M. So I can henceforth set M equal to 1, but we should always keep in mind that we measure things in proper dimensions. So let's say we have some lightest particle M1 being exchanged. By this I mean the first pole in the S matrix. That's what we identify as a particle flowing. We see what are all the particle exchanges and see what is the first pole. And associated to this pole, if I look close to this pole, I read off the coupling. In this case, the coupling M with M1. M1 could be M or it could be another particle. It could be a cubic coupling or it could be that there is some symmetry that forbids M flowing in the middle. Okay? And then the kind of question we could ask is, given a fixed M1 over M, so I tell you what is M1 over M. For example, it can be 1 if there is a cubic coupling. We ask, what is the maximum value of this coupling? Okay? So this is the kind of question we want to ask. And what is the intuition here? The intuition is, I give you some mass, and this mass, you can think of it as some kind of bound state between these two particles. And the intuition is, if you increase the coupling further, you are increasing the binding energy between these two scalars, and you are therefore lowering the mass of the bound state. So there ought to be a maximum value above which you get a contradiction with a given spectrum because you would lower the mass of the particles. Okay? And as I said, the hope is that as we start establishing these bounds and as we start drawing these maximum G surfaces, the hope is that on these surfaces where we have the bound, that on the surface live interesting theories. That is, as I said, the hope. Okay? So any question here? So let me already anticipate a little bit such that you stay until the end of tomorrow. For example, a spoiler that I would give is the following. We can now refine a little bit this question. For example, we can ask, what is the maximum G between two particles of the same mass, M, if we propose that the spectrum, if there exists an M1, M2, and M3 smaller than the threshold, than 2M1, so we say that there are three particles being exchanged, M1, M2, and M3. The lightest one is M1. And we ask, what is the maximum M1? And we fix these values to be the values of Ising with magnetic field. So So I know what are these values of these masses, and I impose that, I try to study field theories with this spectrum of masses. And then, for example, we will find, and I will show you, so I will tell you tomorrow, that this, the answer to this question is that this is exactly the Ising field theory that I spoke about there. That indeed, the Ising field theory, for example, lies at the boundary of these bounds. Okay? No, no. I don't think there is any assumption of that sort. You will see. Okay. So this is the kind of question we are going to ask. And let me tell you what are the main ideas and the main tools we are going to use. So there are two main tools. And today and tomorrow's lecture are basically devoted to these two main ideas that we can use. One idea is to take our quantum field theory, I want to study some quantum field theory or the space of quantum field theories, and let's put it in ADS. So we put the quantum field theory in a box. Say there is a box, our favorite box, so this is ADS. And if I put a big enough box, there is enough space here inside, which looks approximately like flat space. And what happens if I put my quantum field theory in ADS? I put my quantum field theory in a huge box. And then I consider, say, correlation function, four-point function. And then I take these 4 points and drag them to the boundary, such that at the end, I get some points coming from the boundary, interacting in the middle, and going inside. Okay? Then what happens is that because I'm putting the theory on a space with some isometries, I get that automatically, as a consequence of the isometries of ADS, the correlation function of, say, these points, where these points are at the boundary of ADS, they obey all the axioms of a conformal. And let me write field, but cross it out, conformal theory. It will not be a field theory, because there will be no stress tensor, because there is no gravity inside. There is just a massive quantum field theory. I put it inside. I take the correlation functions to infinity. And I get some correlation function that obeys all the axioms of conformal field theory. It has an OP, it has a conformal block decomposition. It is unitary, and so on. But it does not have a stress tensor. An example, a known example, is generalized free field. Okay? The original theory was massive. I'm not very worried about that, but one way I could do it is, for example, first take the massive, think of the massive theory as a CFT perturbed by some relevant operator. Then first put the CFT on half space, and then do a wild transformation to put it in ADS, and then perturbed by the operator. This will be a way that, at all steps, preserves the isometries of ADS. Okay. So indeed, I want to emphasize that this is a consequence of just the isometries of ADS. So for example, there is a very cute exercise that typically I teach at Psi, which has to work, but it's still quite cute to do, which is, for example, suppose I consider ADS. So ADS is the space where I have Minkowski plus some holographic direction. And suppose you do the following fun exercise. So you say that you throw in three geodesics, and you find out the point where these lengths are minimal. And then you compute e to the minus mass times the sum of these minimal lengths. This would be some kind, if you have a massive theory with a big mass, the correlation function of 4 points is given by just the geodesics that propagate through the minimal time. And then you find this point, you work hard, and so on, to find this point. And what result do you find? You find that this computation takes the form of what you expect for a conformal field theory of all the power law dependence. And of course, it's a cute computation to do. You are dealing with massive fields. You minimize. In the end, you get a conformal field theory. I think it's a very instructive exercise. But of course, the result had to be this, just because of symmetries. And what this computation tells you is what exactly is this constant C123, and this constant is not fixed by conformal symmetry. So the idea is therefore to think that we are putting this theory in ADS, we are getting the axioms of a conformal theory, and here we have the conformal bootstrap that we can use. Which carve out what is the possible space of conformal field theories. So by learning about the possible space of conformal field theories in one less dimensions, we aim at learning about S matrix elements of massive theories in one more dimension. Okay? So I'll tell about this in more detail today. And the second tool we are going to use is directly in flat space, discuss the S matrix bootstrap, which takes as input unitarity and crossing symmetry. And we will see that we can also work directly in flat space, revisit the S matrix bootstrap, and understand how can we extract bounds directly from a language of S matrices. Okay? Now this point, as much more material to say than this one, because as you will see, this one is quite simple. So my hope is today to finish this one and start telling a little bit about this one, but we'll see if we can make it or not. Any question about the logic and about the main idea before I start going then into the details of the first point, which is the conformal bootstrap? No? Okay. So as we said, so we take our massive quantum field theory, we put it inside ADS, we study correlation functions, we let the points approach the boundary, and then we get correlation functions that resemble those of a conformal field theory. For example, if I consider the two-point function of a point O of x1, O of x2, which are approaching the boundary, what I will get is 1 over x1 minus x2 to the power 2 delta, where delta is a number, because it's a power. And what is this number delta? This delta is the mass of the particle that is being exchanged, measured in units of ADS radius. So that's how we construct a dimensionless quantity. And we want to take the radius, of course, to infinity, with this delta fixed. In other words, we want the mass, the wavelength of the particle, to be much bigger than the box, such that we are effectively studying flat space limit, such that we are effectively not studying particles in flat space. Okay?
Sorry,
yeah.
You want.
I want to think this delta to be big.
Big, right.
Delta. Yeah, I take MR to be big, such that the mass measured in one unit of R is small. Yeah, of course, this is, I'm emphasizing to be careful with units and then I'm writing such statements. Yeah, I want delta to be big. Very good. So how do we extract, so for example, so if I want to extract, say, a three-point interaction, so I have my box, and I want to do an experiment, and I want to extract a three-point coupling. So how do we do it? So suppose I have, so here is the boundary of ADS. I prepare three points, and I compute the Witten diagram, which is basically the quantum version of this exercise that I said there of integrating over that point. And here you put some coupling G, that is, in your Lagrangian, there is ta-ta-ta-ta-ta plus G phi cube. So in flat space, if you were to put this theory in flat space, G would be the cubic coupling. But instead, if you do the computation in ADS, what do you get? Well, as you say, as I said before, you get this x12, these powers, right? Compatible with conformal symmetry. And then you get the number, and let me write what this number is. This number, which is what we call the structure constant, C123. For example, if you do this computation at large delta, just so that you can have an idea, you get the following. 3 over square root of 2 pi square e to the 3 halves log of 4 thirds times delta minus 1 quarter of log delta. And this is just and then all this times G. Okay? So what I want to, so you, as you see, the three-point function is not directly G, of course, but there is some extra stuff which you can think, more physically speaking, you can think that this interaction, there is some propagation part, and then there is some interaction part. And if you think, for example, in the geodesic approximation, what is this exponential term here? This exponential term here is saying that as I'm propagating, I'm paying e to the minus the length of the geodesic times its mass. So it's a very exponentially small quantity. It costs a lot to go to the middle. And then when I am at the middle, I measure the coupling. Okay? Is it clear? Now, this, here it would be the result of the Witten diagram, but I'm interpreting this exponential. This is in a limit of large delta. So here is at large delta already. And I went up to the constant and I dropped 1 over delta terms. Okay? Yeah, more or less, there is also a bit of log delta, but yeah. Okay. So let me summarize this. It looks at a bunch of simple statements. So, but what is the summary then? The summary is that if I want to extract flat space data, here is how we can do it. So if I ask what is the, what are the couplings in flat space? Well, it's very simple. You just compute the structure constant C123 in our conformal theory, right? And divide by the Witten diagram with interaction 1, which is just this gamma function, not gamma function, already expanded, which is this part here, expression of delta, and then I read off G. Okay? And if I want to be rigorous, what I should do, as we said, we take the limit where all deltas of my theory are becoming very big. What about the other quantity in flat space, which we said, which we discussed in the beginning, ratio of masses, mi over mj in flat space? Well, this will be given by the limit when the deltas, all deltas go to infinity of just the ratio of deltas. Okay? So you take your conformal theory, and as you take ratios of deltas, of course, R drops out, which we want, and we get purely flat space information, the ratio of masses, and the coupling, and the corresponding couplings we extract from the three-point functions of the conformal theory in this way. Okay. Now you can ask, what about more complicated processes like that one? Can I also extract the four-point S matrix directly instead of extracting just the three-point coupling and the masses? Indeed, you can, but it's harder. Because basically, you have now to work out and prepare some precise wave packets at the boundary of ADS, smear out these points, and do it in a careful way such that the interaction region is indeed focused. That's a tough job. We don't need it. We will not need it for what we are going to do, but it's important to have in mind that we could do it in principle. And this has been the work of mostly João Penedonos, but with many collaborators like Takuya Okuda that was also here and so on. And they understood exactly how, if I have this four-point function, how I could also, if I wanted, extract directly the four-point S matrix by, of course, carefully preparing this wave packet such that they are focused. It's really doing an experiment such that we focus and we are really scattering in the middle of the box. But it is purely an exercise of playing with wave packets and making sure that the interaction region is in the middle. And the basic outcome, for those that heard about these recent developments of Mellin amplitude, is that there is a beautiful representation of correlation functions of conformal theories using the so-called Mellin representation, which is a very clever Fourier transform with respect to the cross ratios of the problem. And in Mellin space, after you Fourier transform your correlation function, the flat space limit for any endpoint function is rather trivial, and it is just a particular limit of the Mellin amplitude as some parameters go to infinity. So there is a beautiful story there. Okay.
Usually to do these classical calculations, we have to imagine we're working at large n, something like that. Some large n.
No. No. I'm literally just putting my theory my massive theory in ADS. I'm not using ADS CFT or gravity. I'm just putting my massive theory in ADS, and things change a little bit because propagators now propagate in ADS. So this amputation procedure, for example, in this case for three particles, is described like this. But it is no.
You're ignoring the loop diagrams that would contribute to the proof point?
No, if there would be, the claim is that no, if there would be loop diagrams, you would indeed just extract them in the same way. Because basically there is some propagation region, and then you reach some point where you are interacting. But whatever loops you have, they are all happening inside this dashed ball. And if you just remove this propagation, you would read it off. Okay? I mean, in a few, tomorrow I will contrast the kind of findings we find with, as I said, the field theory of the Ising model, which is as strong as a field theory as you could imagine. It's a fully strongly coupled field theory, where if you were to get the S matrix of the Ising model, you would have to resum all the loops, and there will be nothing like a three-level truncation. So as you will see, it definitely knows about the full quantum theory. OK, so what we are going to do now is, in principle, now we could go on in any number of dimensions, but now I'm going to stick to two dimensions. Okay, for simplicity, the problem is simpler, both from the S matrix bootstrap and from the point of view of the CFT bootstrap, and because we want to see if this program does work, so it's simpler to start with the simplest case first. So we want to do, to study D equal to quantum field theories, which means something almost trivial, we want to study one-dimensional conformal theories. Okay? This is exactly the bootstrap that Davide, Miguel Paulus, and Dali Mil considered. It's exactly the same bootstrap problem in one dimension when they were studying defects in line defects in conformal field theories. So here is what we have. So now we have a one-dimensional conformal theory. So we have our points are in a line. There is the point x1 up to x4. And the conformal theory, for example, if I study a four-point function here, my four-point function, O1 of x1, O4, or let's say the same operator, O of x1 up to O of x4, is given by x1 minus x2 to the power 2 delta, x3 minus x4 to the power 2 delta, and then some function of a single cross ratio, because we are in a line, so there is a single cross ratio z, where z is just, let me see if I have the notation, x1 minus x2 times x3 minus x4 over x1 minus x3, x2 minus x4. Okay? This is what we know based on conformal theory, based on conformal symmetry. And then the conformal bootstrap goes, I'm sure you heard many talks about it, that we say that this function of a cross ratio, I can decompose it as a sum of positive numbers, which represent the coupling square between the operator OO and some operator exchanged OK, and I sum over what operator I exchange, and then some function which is totally fixed by symmetry that only depends on the dimension of the exchanged operator that depends on Z. And this function, just to be totally explicit, in this case, it's very simple. It is just Z to the power minus 2 delta plus delta K times an hypergeometric function f2k of delta k, 2 delta k, z. This is the analog of a plane wave. It's the wave that describes the propagation of a primary and all its descendants. So it's the analog of a spherical harmonic or a conformal wave. It's the relevant function for describing propagation in a conformal field theory from two points to two other points. And the key thing now to proceed with this conformal bootstrap is to say, well, these numbers here, because this process is representing summing over operators and there is a symmetry along this line, if you think so, there is a reflection positivity, there is unitarity. So these constants here are positive. Here is where unitarity is entering. And then this function must be equal to A of 1 minus z, and this is where crossing is entering, because this object is nothing but exchanging the points and thinking from the opposed channel. So here is where crossing enters. Okay? So now, the basic idea, as you see, is now, so the goal now is to establish bounds on C, which then translates into general bounds on G after I translate back to flat space. Okay? So I fix some spectrum. This gives me some condition on the deltas. I try to bound these Cs. If I bound the Cs, I automatically bound the Gs. Okay? So that's the basic idea. Any question? So what I'm going to describe now is totally standard. It's the way this bootstrap goes. But given that it's... But I want to tell you a little bit about it nonetheless. Okay. Sorry? Yes. Positivity of the ball theory, yeah, because you have the two points, right? They are approaching the boundary, they are approaching a symmetric configuration. So you have reflection positivity all the way as you are approaching the boundary. Yeah, so again, what I was saying, unitarity, I mean, often we think of unitarity as reflection positivity. I think it's a cute way of thinking. It is just a statement that if you have a unitary theory, and if you have any correlation function which is symmetric with respect to a plane, you can always think of that path integral as saying that I prepare a wave function, and then I prepare the conjugate wave function, and I'm computing a norm, so it must be positive. And what David was pointing out is that indeed, because I have this symmetric configuration all the way from the ball, because I'm approaching the boundary, always having this symmetry, unitarity is guaranteed at the boundary. Okay, so now let me tell you how do people like Slava, Rishkov, and others have developed tools to establish bounds based on this equation. So these equations are very tough to solve. So no one has hopes, or it's generally very tough to solve this kind of crossing equations exactly. But the idea is to explore the fact that we are adding up positive stuff to get to contradictions. And as soon as I get a contradiction, I rule something out. And then because I rule something out, I establish a bound. Okay, so the idea is to explore the fact that we are summing positive things to try to get to contradictions and in this way rule out some particular three-point functions or some particular spectrum and in this way bound these quantities. So I'm going to be fast because I'm sure people heard several talks. This was already developed more or less in 2008. So I want to be relatively fast on this. So let me recall first how the usual bounds, which is not what I want to do, but I want to remind how the bounds on the spectrum, the first version on how to establish bounds on the spectrum go. How do I try to rule out some deltas? And the idea is the following. We write the crossing equations. Okay? We write it in the following way. Let me already write it in the following way. Let me say that this is, I have the structure constant of O with identity, which is just 1, times, let me write and then you will see what I mean by this, function identity of Z plus, I want to write it in this way because it's useful for the next point as well. O with first guy exchanged times 1 plus C O, the other guys exchanged. And I'm forgetting squares, which is the most important thing. And I sum over them times some F other equal to 0. So here all I did was something very simple. All I did was I took this equation, I put this term and the same thing with z minus 1 minus z on the same side. I looked at the coefficient of c o with o first, and I divide by whatever function of z multiplies it such that this constant appears with a 1, just because I want for the argument later. Then this function with identity is just a ratio of disconnected parts. It's something simple. And then the others is something. But the point is that these functions here of z, again, it's very important to emphasize this. These guys are known. They are just some particular ratios of hypergeometrics, some differences and ratios of hypergeometrics. So these guys are well known, and these are just simple functions. Okay? So is this clear, this equation? I mean, it's just simple algebra. Okay. Now, the second step is to introduce linear functionals. Let me introduce a family of linear functionals, alpha, acting on something. And let me say, for example, it can be anything works roughly. But I can say that I sum c to the n. I take some n derivatives of this something. And then I set z equal to 1/2. OK, 1/2 is a symmetric point. OK, so I'm acting with this linear functional. And you see, parametrizing this linear functional is parametrizing this constant cn. So I have a space of linear functionals. And now I'm going to choose these linear functions in a clever way to try to reach contradictions when I act with these linear functionals on this equation. OK? So the basic idea is then, suppose first, so imagine that you give me a spectrum, given a spectrum, delta J, if given a spectrum delta J, we manage to find an alpha, a functional alpha, such that alpha acting on all these functions and alpha acting on 1, alpha acting on 1, you see, it is just C0, it's just a constant C0, such that this is negative. OK? Note that this definitely depends on the spectrum, because the functions we are acting on, they depend on the deltas. So given a spectrum, so you conjecture a spectrum. And for some spectrums, you propose some crazy spectrum of your theory. For example, you tell me that I have 4 operators of dimension 1, and the next operator has dimension 1 million. That would be a totally crazy spectrum. This would not exist. I will be able easily to find a functional where this is true. And then what happens if I do? If I act with this functional, I reach an impossibility. Because I act with this functional, I get negative number, negative number, negative number, summed with positive coefficients. So if we work, if we find an alpha, it implies the spectrum is ruled out. OK? So this is what people have been doing to rule out spectra. And as I said before, for example, right now, people managed to plot the dimension of magnetization versus dimension of energy ionizing model. And they isolated an island very carefully by doing exactly this bounce and by ruling out almost everything except a tiny, tiny, tiny island where the size of this island is smaller than the error bars of that you would get if you were to compute this in Monte Carlo. OK? So I want to emphasize something that in typically to look for these functionals, you use a computer because you parameterize this functional. And what you do, you try to compute it with as many parameters as you can, n equals 0 up to some capital N. You try to make a big space of functionals. And then you let the computer search for functionals. But I want to emphasize something important, that even though this is a numerical method, if you want, it's a computer-based method, all bounds are exact, right? Namely, if I find one bound, if I find one alpha that gives me all negative numbers, I'm sure this is impossible. There is no way I could improve my computers and suddenly find that this theory is possible, because I just reached the contradiction. So this spectrum is impossible. So what can happen is that with better and better computers, the plot can go down, but it can never go up. It's an exact block, bound. OK? So these bounds, it's not really numerical. It is just analytic, but with the help of computer. Because we need a computer to find good functionals. But when we find good functionals, there are no error bars in this stuff. It is just, you just rule things out. So what about how do we, this rules out spectrum. You see, it doesn't rule out these C's. So how do we find bounds on C's? This is a bit less known. So let me tell you how we find bounds on C's. Bounds on C's, it's a variation of this. OK? So this is the basic, this is the most simple. And this is a variation. And the variation says, look, try to search for alpha. So look for alpha such that alpha acting on f of other f alpha acting on f of other. Is smaller than zero, and alpha acting on f of the first guy, which is just one, as the way I normalized, is equal to one. Okay? But you don't impose anything on the identity. You don't impose anything on the identity. Then, when you pass this, all these terms to the other side, then this implies automatically that if you find such functional, then your structure constant O first needs to be smaller or equal to this, to minus this functional acting on F for the exchange of the identity. Because you get again this plus a bunch of positive things. Okay? Is it clear? If I pass this to the other side. So this structure constant square must be smaller or equal to this. This is a variation because this also rules out spectrum, because imagine you find a functional that obeys this and then this is negative. Then you are reaching a contradiction, so it also rules out the spectrum. So it either rules out spectrum or provides a bound on C. When this quantity here is positive, it's providing a bound on C. When it's negative, it's ruling out the spectrum. Okay? So in this way, what we can generate is plots where we draw the maximum g as function of delta. So what we can do is now plot this maximum g. And now let me tell you what we do, and then I'll show you really the plots in the computer. So let me tell you what we do. So sorry? If I did it carefully, I want it to be negative, because then I pass it to the other side and I get something positive on the other side, right? So I get something positive plus the contribution from the identity. I think it's correct. Does someone disagree with me? I think it's correct, right? Because this, this thing is equal to this minus the sum of C squared times alpha of F other, and this is positive. Ah, okay, I want bigger. Right, so this is negative, so COO must be smaller than, very good, thank you, yeah. Right, so then this is smaller or equal than, exactly. Very good. So this is how these bounds go. So now what you do is you use, as I said, computers to search for these functionals. This is something that is now very well developed. There are basically two competing softwares to do these searches, one developed by David Simon Duffins and one developed by Miguel Paulus. And we are actually using both. And we are using them at CERN's cluster. And Miguel Paulus and Balt are fighting for cluster time. And we are cross-checking all the results. But what we can then plot is the following. So I can now say, let's see what kind of plots we do. We say we plot this maximum g, or it's typically better to plot log of this maximum g. What is this? You compute the maximum of C, divide by this Witten diagram stuff to convert it into a flat space quantity. You fix the gap. What's the gap? Is this mass of the first guy over mass of the external, which is delta of the first guy over delta of the external. And you plot this as function of delta external. Okay? Now, this procedure could work or not work. And what would it mean to work? It would mean that we reach a flat space limit. So as I'm taking this delta to be small, I get some bound. And this bound is changing. It's something. Now, what must happen as I'm increasing this delta? What must happen as I'm increasing this delta is that this log g, which I remind you is the structure constant divided by a bunch of non-trivial factors, must start bending and approach a plateau. And then the height of this plateau would be the g of flat space. Okay? This will be the coupling of flat space as we are asymptoting to infinite deltas. So this would be the G of flat space maximum for this ratio M1 over M. Okay? In practice, what we do, just to give you a better idea, is that we don't find a plateau. And we don't find a plateau, this is a numerical issue. It is just that in practice, we look for finitely many functionals. So this N is fixed. So in practice, this is what we have to do. We start with some N, say N equal 20. Then we do N equal 40. Then we do N equal 60. And we went up to N equal 200 and it didn't really converge. So we have to work a bit hard. We have to say for each point here, we then extrapolate and fit and see where the point would be. What's our guess for N equal infinity? Okay? So for each value of delta, we fit in N and see where it was going to go. Of course, this step introduces error bars. Because before, this bound was totally exact. And as I said, this is ruled out for sure. And then, as I said, with a better computer, you can rule out more. Indeed, you go down and you rule out this. Then you rule out this. But now as you fit, perhaps the exact bound was slightly above and you are ruling out something slightly better. So in this procedure of fitting, there is now some error, some systematic error being introduced. But okay, here we are not being mathematicians anymore, we are being physicists, and this is definitely giving a much better approximation. So there is one fit in N. And then I get a curve in delta, and what I'm going to do is fit delta going to infinity. So what we are going to do is for each delta 1 over delta external, which is the gap, we do this double fit. And then the really interesting plot is the final plot in flat space, which is what is the maximum g as function of the mass of the exchanged guy over the mass of the initial guy. This goes from 0 to 2. Let's plot as a function of the mass square. It goes from 0 to 4, right? And then we will see that we get some nice curve that looks something like this. And this tells you something, that if you have some guy with mass square root of 3, and if you are plotting the coupling, the claim is that there is no quantum field theory which has a coupling bigger than this value. No massive quantum field theory here. Okay? And here, perhaps, we don't know. Okay? So this region here is allowed. And this region, this point there, is definitely forbidden. Okay? So if this is correct, I find it cute in the sense that what we are doing here, you see, is predicting a bound for two-dimensional massive quantum field theories using one-dimensional conformal bootstrap. So the claim is that the S matrix bootstrap in for massive theories in D dimensions is contained in the bootstrap of conformal theories in D minus one dimensions. Which I think, if true, is quite amusing, that we go one less dimension, we go to a simpler class of theories, and we are claiming to have information about the bootstrap. So let me just show you so that you see a little bit how these things work in practice. So I should turn this on. And I'm in, okay, I'm doing very good on time. So, just so that you see that there's nothing fancy here. Okay, but while this loads, is there any question here? Yeah.
So if I construct this above standard for my conformal theory in the bulk and then mass conforming it.
Yes.
When you put a conformal theory in the ES, you must have picked the boundary conformal magnetic condition to the boundary. Is this somehow washed away when you put on the mass conformation?
It should be, right? Because intuitively, if you have some massive theory, it doesn't reach the boundary. But you see what I'm doing technically, right?
No,
so we should discuss more what exactly it means from the boundary conditions. But I think it should be washed out because, or perhaps there are some very drastic boundary conditions that don't have a flat space limit because they oblige stuff to go to the boundary. And those are very severe, bad boundary conditions that don't correspond to putting things in a big box. Right, because you would still oblige the particles to go all the way to the boundary. But the more reasonable boundary conditions, the effect of the masses would just fall off and it should not matter. So here is, for example, this is the full notebook, you see. There's nothing more, just this. After Balt and Miguel did all the work, and they produced this data. So what I do is I load the data. You see data, and I call the data from some notebook directories. So let me show you what this data looks like. So I ask data. Oh, Portugal wants more austerity. You see the crisis? It's terrible. Okay. So we have the data. The output is too big to show. We can ask, what's the length of this data? How much points? We have 3,400 points of data. So what is a point of data? Let's extract one point. So for example, point number 1,900. So here is a point. Here is it is. So let me explain what this is. What is 60? 60 is how many derivatives are we using? This n, this 60 that I said. What is 3/2? 3/2 is the gap. We are saying that we have a particle being exchanged, which has a mass 1.5 of the external mass. What is this 18.2? 18.2 is the mass of the external guy. You say it's far from infinity. It's not yet infinity. It's just 18. And what is the corresponding coupling once converted, once taken the log and converted to flat space is 15.05. Okay? So this is the kind of data we get. I should emphasize one thing, which makes all this very tricky, is that in principle, this dimension, how big this dimension is, how big this n needs to be, it increases more and more as you increase delta. So it becomes trickier and trickier to do. Okay, good. So let me just remind myself what I want to show you. Okay? So for example, as we said, we can look at this data. Let me just do it very quickly. And say, let's ask for everyone which has this gap and this dimension, right? And we can plot it, you see? And this is being plotted now as function of n. Oops. I want to see the first two points. And I'm plotting. And you see what's happening is that as I'm increasing more and more derivatives, I start with 40 derivatives, then 50, then 60, 80, and so on. It's converging, but you see clearly it didn't converge yet, right? This didn't converge yet. If I'm n equal infinity, I don't know, it will be somewhere here perhaps, right? So I have to fit it. It would be bad to use this last value. It would be silly to take this last value. It clearly did not converge yet. So then we fit for each n. So here is what is being done. So let me now just show you. So here you see, you take this data and select the particular gap and delta and fit in n. And you see how we are fitting in n. It's kind of fun to see how this is working. We are fitting in n with actually a huge number of parameters. We fit it n with, we have our points and we fit with 1 over n, 1 over n squared, 1 over n cubed. We go like up to 1 over n to the 8. Typically, you never do such fits with such a large number of n's. But here we do it precisely because we have a huge precision. In fact, these computations, they need to be done with very high precision. Why? Because it's of the physics of the experiment. We have a huge box, and we are sending some particles from this box, and we have the identity contribution, and then we have the interaction. So you see what you have to do? You have to subtract off the identity and read off the interaction. That interaction is exponentially small compared to the identity, because these geodesics, they have a much smaller length, the ones which go directly. After you subtract, you have to divide by this exponential propagation, which introduces lots of error. And then you have finally the flat space limit. So for example, Miguel Paulus, in his intermediate computations, he has to carry like 800 digits when doing this bootstrap. Otherwise, you get crappy results. But given that we worked so hard to have a lot of precision, our values in n are very good. So we can use many values of n to fit. Then we extrapolate and we get the curve for n equal infinity, and then we fit it in delta. And the fit in delta, we will just use 1 over delta, 1 over delta square, because we are less sure about the nature of the expansion in large delta. Does it contain logs? We don't know the nature of the expansion at large deltas. And then we plot it. So here is, and then we plot it. So here is the plot, and I can now show you the plot. And you see here is the curve I set. So the points above these points are forbidden, and below are allowed. And I even put here some sliders such that you can see that this is how many terms we used in the 1 over n expansion. If I put less, you see the plot becomes a bit crappier. Here, close to the end, and it becomes crappier and crappier. And I should really use as many points in n as I can to make it smoother as possible. And in delta, the same thing. If I use less points in delta, you see some points, I lose precision. And I should also choose the right number of points to get the smooth curve as smooth as possible. So tomorrow, and I'll still use some time today, but tomorrow we will reproduce this curve from the S matrix bootstrap and actually see that we can reproduce this curve analytically. And we will make an analytic prediction for what this curve is, and then we'll put it on top and see the black curve passing exactly through the points. So it will be lots of fun, and now I'm spoiling the surprise. Okay, very good. But so this gives us confidence that this is okay. Okay, so in the remaining part of the time, so.
Hey, before you.
Yeah.
You talked about how in delta you weren't sure, you know, the nature of the curve.
Yeah.
Are you sure about what gives you intuition that you can just use integer powers, say, for your n?
Ah, that's a good point. That's because we just see the behavior of n and observe that, because typically what you do is you fit. And you see how it changes if you change the number of parameters. If it doesn't change, you guessed a good fit. What we see with delta is if I put more parameters in delta, the fit is very unstable. So we don't know the nature of the fit. It's not that we don't know. We know what we have is wrong. So I just don't know. Perhaps there is 1 over delta times log delta. I just don't know. It's a complicated problem. I also don't know why n is power-like, but I observe that it is numerical. Okay, so this is basically the idea. So of course now you can say, well, if this works, we could now try to go to higher dimensions and bootstrap quantum field theory in higher dimensions using CFT in one less dimension. And indeed, we have numerics running, but I will now tell you about the analytic stuff about the two dimensions. Okay, so am I right that I have 1 hour and a half, or are people destroyed and I should start tomorrow and tomorrow use 2 hours for the S matrix? Right now, I'm at the end of 1 hour, or 55 minutes. Okay, I think Davide is giving a very clear answer.
He's taking a short break.
He's going to be back? Okay, so then I think I will continue, and I will start actually by telling something that I think it's some intuition that is useful, that I will tell again, that I will kind of use tomorrow. And given that it is standard thing that some people learn in undergrad, I'm sure Davide knows it already very well. So maybe it's a good thing to start by that. And given that it's something standard, I didn't want to lose people's time, so I prepared it already. Okay, so I want to remind you a couple of things about S matrices. And something very simple that people often get confused is when I write something like this and say that this S is an S matrix. Okay, so this is something basic just from quantum mechanics and understanding what is an S matrix. Typically, we think of an S matrix as preparing something at minus infinity, scattering and receiving something at plus infinity. But often, I also use the following words. I say, let me prepare a wave function for two particles with momentum k1 and k2. And I say, there is an incoming wave, and then there is an outgoing wave with a coefficient that I call the S matrix. And here, it's a stationary wave. It's a stationary problem, and I just compute a stationary wave function. This is also what we do in school when we start learning quantum mechanics. We have, say, a step function, and we consider the stationary wave function. And then we say this is reflected, this is transmitted, but everything is stationary. So we might wonder, what is moving? Where is time equal minus infinity plus infinity? Everything is here stationary. Okay? But of course, there is a very simple answer to this, which, as I said, is textbook material, but I want to remind you, which is that, in fact, this is a very idealized situation. What you should do to consider something more realistic is convolute this wave function with wave packets and time evolve it. So the wave packets means that the momentum is not exactly k1 and k2, but it's centered around some momentum p1. It's centered around some momentum p2. And this is a more realistic wave function. So you multiply by these wave packets, and then you time evolve. And what does time evolution mean? Time evolution means you insert here e to the minus k1 squared times time minus k2 squared times time. Okay, so insert the energy times time. And now this wave function that now evolves in time is a more realistic wave function describing the system. And how does this wave function behave? How do I see this wave function? And what happens if I ask, where are the particles? Well, where are the particles? The particles are where the phase here are where the phase is not changing much when the k's are roughly the k's of the wave packets. So I go and I study stationary phase for each of the two plane waves. And what do I get? I get x1 minus k1t equals 0 and x2 minus k2t equals 0 for the first exponential. Let me put the standard 1/2 that they never put. Right? This is what we get for the first exponential. And we get this for the second exponential. Okay? So you see that this stationary wave function, if I say that this is the wave function, right, for x1 smaller than x2, these particles are bosons, so this is the only thing I give you. The other wave function is just the symmetric of this. Then we are saying that x2 minus x1 is positive. Let me suppose I consider a situation like this where k1 is positive and k2 is negative. So k2 minus k1 is negative. And therefore, the only way you can satisfy these equations is if time is negative for the first exponential. For the second exponential, it's similar, but with k1 and k2 exchange. So the only way you can satisfy these equations is if time is positive. So indeed, the time evolution of this system is that you start with a plane wave, you time evolve it, and you go to the other plane wave. And what is the amplitude? It's the S matrix. OK? So this is just the usual conversion between stationary waves and time evolution. And let me, by the way, mention, for example, what happens. I would like to mention two features of these wave functions. The first thing I would like to mention is what are wave functions of such with such S matrices for three particles in an integrable theory. Okay. So in an integrable theory, the wave function psi is a sum of terms, which I will draw like this. This plus this plus this plus this plus this plus this, where each term has an associated. So for example, let me write this one. It's clear. So this one is e to the I momentum k1 went to position x3, momentum k2 went to position x1, momentum k3 went to position x2. And particle 1 scattered with particle 2 said there will be an S matrix S of P1, P2, or K1, K2. And particle 1 scattered with particle 3, so there will be an S matrix of K1, K3. Okay? And similarly for the others. And then we say that these S's here, we can think of them as S matrices. So let me just tell you that there's something fun that you can do, the following exercise. You can start with this wave function and again convolute it with wave packets to see where are really particles. But now notice something. When I convoluted with wave packets, I put here t. Why didn't I put t minus t now? I could. And then I'm starting really the experiment is designed such that particles start at meet at position t now. So of course I can prepare my wave packets with any shift of time here. So what you can do is you prepare the wave packets such that the particles are going to meet, say, in this order. Okay? And now what you can see is that you can now look at each of these plane waves and look at the stationary phase, and you can see, you get something very intuitive, which is, of course, what you expect. You see that there are three important times now. It's not just t bigger than 0 and t smaller than 0. And there is a time ta, a time tb, and a time tc. And if I am below ta, the wave, only wave function that has support here is the first one. So here I measure this wave function. If I am between TA and TB, particle 1 and 2 scattered, this wave function is the only one that has support there. Between TB and TC, particle 2 and 3 also scatter, so only this one that we just described has support there. And after TC, everyone scattered with everyone, so only this wave function has support. So at each separate time, I'm measuring the different wave functions, and the coefficients are the various products of S matrix. And in this way, I measure 4 of the 6 terms. And of course, if I had designed different wave packets such that this line happens here, I would measure the other 2. Okay? The second comment I would like to make, again, about general stuff about S matrices, I want to remind you that poles of S matrix are typically associated to bound states. When we have a pole of an S matrix, we associate it to a bound state. And indeed, there is something that we can see, for example, from this picture here. So suppose let K2 be equal to some K20 plus minus I times some imaginary part, and K1 to be equal to some K0 plus I times some imaginary part. So I'm taking 2 particles and putting them with real momentum and some complex parts. This is what a bound state is. Now, what happens to this wave function? It becomes bad because this term explodes now. If I did it carefully, if I was careful about this sign, with this eta being positive, I tried to be careful such that this term explodes. Okay? So if this term explodes, this is a bad wave function. It's not a normalizable wave function. So what's the way out? The way out is if this S matrix develops a pole such that as I approach the pole, I have the right to turn this term, to throw this term away. Right? Because the wave function, okay, I can think that I put this 1 over S here, then a pole is killing this term. Right? So this is bad. So I can do this. It's okay if S of K1, K2 has a pole there. When it does, I just drop this first term, and I get just some wave function that indeed moves with some center of mass and decays exponentially away from the center of mass. And that's exactly what a bound state is. Okay? And of course, you see that it's important, you have to be careful that here I chose some particular sign. If I choose the opposite sign, it doesn't work. If I choose the opposite sign, then this term would go to 0. So it's not only about having poles in the S matrix, it's about having poles in the right position. I need to have poles in the right position in the complex plane. If I want, when this guy explodes, I want this guy to explode, not this guy to go to 0, otherwise I'm only making the problem worse. Right? So poles in the right position of the S matrix correspond to bound states. That's the first thing. And we also see that if my theory is factorized, if I have an integrable theory, right, then what happens is that I can construct explicitly the S matrix for a bound state with a fundamental particle. In an integrable theory, I want to write the following equation, that the S matrix of a bound state with a fundamental particle is equal to the S matrix of the fundamental particle with momentum k plus I eta, comma p, times the S matrix of k minus I eta p, where p is the momentum of the fundamental particle and k is the momenta of the bound state. So you can just take 2 fundamental S matrices and multiply them to get the S matrix involving a bound state and a fundamental particle. And one way of seeing it is just that if you look at what would happen if I take 3 particles, right? And now go to the position where 2 of them become a bound state. Approach a bound state. Then what happens? This term is regular. This one explodes, so I care about this term. This one is regular, and this term explodes, so I also care about this term, because there is an interaction between 1 and 2, so it explodes. This one is regular, and now I'm confused, 1 second. I did some mistake somewhere. This one is also relevant. Give me 1 second. What have I done wrong? Just 1 second. Ah, okay. Okay, the argument is more tricky because of the exponentials. This one will decay much faster than this other two. Okay, I don't want to explain it like this. I want to explain it in a different way. I want to use a different argument. I want to say that what we learn in this integrable theories is that the S matrix of three particles going into three particles, so if I start from the very past and go to the very future, is equal to a factorized product of 2 to 2 S matrices, right? This is something we learned, that from minus infinity to plus infinity, I get a product of 3 2 to 2 S matrices. Do you agree? But now, an S matrix in any theory, if I have a three-body S matrix, I know the following. I know that there is the following on-shell process. There is an on-shell process where I take particle 1 and 2 and form a bound state. Then this bound state interacts with particle 3. A bound state gets out that splits into 1 and 2 and 3. This is compatible with an on-shell process. If I have a bound state in my theory, I can put this leg on shell, I can put all legs on shell and construct this process. This is what people call a Landau diagram. And then, in general, you can say that if this is true, this process, I also can predict the residue exactly. It must be the coupling between fundamental and bound state that appears in the bottom and in the top, square, times the S matrix, which appears in the middle, between the bound state and the fundamental particle. Now let's apply this logic to this result where we have the S matrix. What happens if I go to the position where I have this pole between 1 and 2? If I go to the position of the pole between 1 and 2, this S matrix here, the first one, produces exactly a G squared that I wanted, because this S matrix contains exactly a pole where I exchange the bound state with residue G squared. So if I take the residue here, the G square is good. And what remains? What remains, if I ignore this line, this bottom part, is just a product of two S matrices where the constituents have the moment of the bound state. So if the theory factorizes, scattering with a bound state is very simple. You just scatter with the constituents of the bound state. Okay? So if a theory is integrable, you scatter with its constituents. Another way of thinking about it that some people like is the following. You think more physically, that you have two particles, and they propagate in space, they form a bound state, and then they move. And then you scatter that bound state with some other particle. But now, because we have integrability, that we can move wave packets freely, we can make the particle scatter before it formed the bound state. And then we get that formula there. So there is this cute intuition about thinking about that formula as well. So let me see just one more thing. So poles correspond to bound states, I said. Integrable theories are those where scattering is factorized. In those theories, we can construct S matrices of higher particles like bound states by this process, which is called fusion. And I think I'll start the bootstrap of relativistic S matrices tomorrow. And so today, all we did was finish the conformal bootstrap and introduce some intuition that will be helpful that allows us to freely translate between time evolution and an S matrix from minus to plus infinity to talking about stationary waves. People should now be comfortable with this switch back and forth. Okay, so I'll stop here. Thank you. The analytic curve?
Yeah, the cusp.
The cusp. There is some understanding of this cusp, yes, from some reflection symmetry argument that Oguri found recently, but it's something I did not study in great detail. But indeed, when we predicted this cusp from the CFT bootstrap, from the S-matrix bootstrap, then we went back and analyzed, and indeed, there is some tricky ways of understanding why these points 2 could be special. This is at the point 2. It's when the mass is square root of 2 times the mass of the external guy. Then there is this. In fact, it's a square root divergence. It blows up. So there is no bound here.
All right, not going to thank that again. Yeah.